comes from Kebabzi and Phoenician Restro Cafe.
What?
Featuring Mediterranean cuisine just north of the UT campus at 2909 Guadalupe. Kebabzi offers dine-in, takeout, and catering of Mediterranean classics for lunch and dinner 7 days a week.
7 days?
More information available at kebabzi.com.
Fall in love with the worst times of your life all over again.
The Cringe.
Sundays at 5 p.m. hosted by DJ DeChico.
And DJ Deep Space.
Where we embrace all the things we used to hide.
Fandoms.
Twilight.
Minecraft.
Creepypasta.
Anime.
Angsty poetry.
Warrior Cats.
Only on KVRX 91.7 FM.
DJ Geist is here speaking German. That means no. This show is sponsored by Collins.
No, sir. Wait, why can I not hear you?
Hello?
Oh, I can hear you.
This show is sponsored by Collins.
Can you hear
voice.
Me?
Yeah.
Dude, I can hear you in my headphones.
Yeah, me too.
What? That's crazy.
Dude, tongue.
Hey, guys, y'all are listening
oh,
to
is it our show?
91.7 KVRX. No, it's not time for our show, but.
Yeah, we're just kind of doing
it. No one was in the booth. It was on auto, so we figured we'd hop in and say what's up to y'all.
Yeah, y'all have some crappy music on auto.
Anyways.
Is that some Yiddish shit? I'm just confused.
And so.
Oh. One against. What does it say? I don't know what that says.
Anyways. This guy, dude.
Changing of the topic.
So.
DJ DeMorgans.
Yeah.
What is this show sponsored by?
Can we move on, dude?
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Can you focus?
Yeah.
All right. Anyways.
And who? Who's?
We're going to go to break. I'll call y'all back. This is ridiculous. This is DJ DeMorgans.
This is DJ Geist.
We're on a little early tonight. Nobody was in the booth, so we figured we'd hop in and say what's up and go ahead and get moving. Because we've got a long show tonight.
Do we really? I'm pulling my Google Doc.
Mine will be.
Mine's kind of long. Mine's like 7 pages. How long is yours?
Double spaced?
Yeah.
20. But single spaced, it's like 11.
Dude, why'd you put in that much information?
I don't know, but I put a lot.
You're going to make her cranky.
Yeah, I know. She goes, if you put too much, I'm going to be cranky. Hey, sorry, guys. Just philosophy, we think,
philosophy,
early.
We think, possibly early.
Yeah. But we're a philosophy talk show. So
I did put in too much information for Mala Branch, and then I put in rudimentary information for Hume, because I'm like, I don't get it.
I don't know how you don't get Hume. What do you not get about him?
I don't know. I just...
Like, no, like, what do you not get? Like... Can this thing... There we go. Oh, that's just what I've been wanting.
Pull it a little, dude.
Yeah, I've just been wanting to sit back in my chair, but the mic wouldn't come to me. Anyways, so... I don't even know if I want to wear this anymore.
Yeah, it's not that. It's not as hype as I thought it was.
I thought wearing headphones would be great. It's not that great.
Yeah.
Anyways.
I just weirdly hear the studio air and then.
This I'm taking them off.
All right.
I'm taking them off. It's better when it's just a real conversation.
Yeah. So,
what did I do? What do I not get? Like, I guess I get it, but, like, it's just so simple. I'm like, that can't be it. Like, where's my doc at, dude?
So, for those of you who have been following us, you know what we're talking about. For those of you who haven't, I'll give you a quick little intro or, like, brief on what we're talking about this semester is ethics, specifically a sort of history of ethics, ethical theories throughout time. We wrote down that we were going to get to Kant tonight.
I'm a Kantian, boys.
Okay. I'm sure we would love to hear about that.
Yeah.
But I don't know if we'll actually get to Kant. Maybe we may touch on it a little bit at the end, but probably not. What we'll be spending most of the time on tonight is talking about some theories and questions that relate to our exam that we're taking. You've turned yours in, right?
Nope.
Oh, no, you haven't.
Have you?
Huh?
Have you?
No, but. I'm done.
Yeah, I'm done too.
Yeah.
I was working on it all day today, dude, and I couldn't focus, dude.
Really?
Yeah, dude, there was a whole conference.
Yeah, there was a lot of people.
A non-conference conference.
But we've been doing ethical theories, so we've covered Aristotle, we've covered Malebranche, we've covered Hume. Did we cover anybody else in ethics? I know we've done
Malebranche for one episode. We didn't cover his ethics, though. We just talked about his metaphysics.
No, we talked about his ethics.
Oh, did we?
Yeah. Yeah, no, we talked about his ethics. But we've taken some asides and talked about our thesis project.
We talked about John Dewey. I read at Stanford and read some writings in his
book.
This
guy, dude. This guy. This guy reads one paper about John Dewey, and he's like, actually?
I'm a
this is my guy.
This is my guy, dude.
But anyways, so for those of you who listen, you know all that already. But basically, we're covering ethical theories.
No one listens, bro.
We have a couple, like, three or four.
Our moms don't count.
We got like one or two out there.
Okay.
There's at least like one or two people.
Anyone from Juice listens?
On and off, but no, I don't think they're consistent.
Yeah.
No, but I do think there's probably a couple people out there that are like consistent listeners.
Yeah. Oh, I do think Sadie is the one that called out last time.
Called out?
Yeah. You remember when like that one guy was like,
oh yeah. But they don't know what we're talking about, so listen.
Oh yeah, let's move on. We're just boys with everyone at Juice.
Yeah, Juice Land.
Juice.
Shout out Juice Land on Guad. That's our spot.
That's our spot, dude. That's where we relax because that's the only time we actually have time to hang out.
Yeah. Play pinball.
Yeah. Dude, I broke a record today. I'm second
place. Yeah, you went crazy, dude. Didn't you score like 500,000 on pinball?
Yeah, dude. I was focused. I wasn't even worried about. Yeah, I was focused.
That's good. You got some goo sauce in you. Feeling
yeah,
good.
Dude, I'm a little cracked.
Wow. Okay.
But we've been covering ethical theories. Yeah, I don't think that's all we covered. We covered our thesis a couple times. That's about it.
So tonight we're going to be doing sort of like a synthesis of three.
Don't ever say that word.
Why? Synthesis?
Yeah.
But why? It made sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're not dialectical, bro.
It wasn't referenced in that way. In the same way that Malebranche talks about the understanding, not in the same way that Aristotle talks about intuition.
Yeah, okay.
I can say the word synthesis without talking about dialectics.
Fair.
Anyways, so we're going to be doing like a little summary or just like movement.
Yeah, I guess
recap,
a summary.
Of what we've been doing. So, do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
I mean, I can cover some Malebranche.
Let's do one and one. So, like, you do one, I'll do one?
Yeah.
Okay. You're up. What do you got first?
What does the F stand for in title page?
All right. Not that one.
Okay, yeah.
That's no content.
Oh, it's true. So, I answer, like, the third question. The main idea of Malebranche's moral theory
is that our goal is to achieve perfection. This is the question, by the way. Explain how we can achieve perfection according to Malebranche. Be sure to give details about what faculties we have, how Malebranche thinks we can use or best make use of this of them, this faculty. Wait. She uses her she words the questions weird.
Yeah, she they were a little oddly worded.
So Malebranche thinks humans have this faculty of rationality like most philosophers.
Yeah, Aristotle.
Yeah.
Kant.
Yeah, everyone like is
even him.
Yeah. First it should be mentioned. Dude, am I just gonna read it like a script?
It's up to you.
Oh, okay.
So like, I might do that with mine just to like catch things, you know.
Yeah, that's true. So like first it should be mentioned that that universal reasons or expressions of God are the wisdom of God himself. This is like a good starting off point, and then I can explain what that means.
Yeah.
So universal reason is an expression of God.
Right.
Himself. It's basically God's knowledge. That's all.
Well, you have to explain what it means for reason to be universal.
Oh, it's just like, oh, well, it's.
Yeah, you know what?
Do we have to? I don't
think
I tonight. Have to.
Sorry, guys. If you're not a. Normally, we strive to like at least try to explain.
I mean, it's pretty simple. Like, reason is universal because God's.
I'm talking about down the line. I'm not going back tonight. Like, I'm not gonna stop and like make asides to like explain little concepts.
Oh, okay, okay.
Just like as a general rule tonight, we're not gonna. Like, normally we are totally open and happy to like explain concepts in a most like basic and understandable way.
Yeah.
Tonight we apologize, but this is like more a show that we're gonna do towards a higher, I guess, a higher level audience. Not really, but yeah. A more philosophy specific audience.
Well, yeah, but since you mentioned anyways for this, I'll just say so. Reason's just universal because God is universal.
Right.
It's quite straight. It's straightforward from Malebranche, I guess. So, but I think, and from there, I have to mention his metaphysical theory. And he thinks that God is the only causal power and creates expressions. Now, him being a causal power, it doesn't matter for his ethical theory so much. But these expressions of himself do matter for his ethical theory. And where am I at? So this idea of expressions or volitions or laws of So expressions, volitions or laws are all the same thing. They're kind of exchangeable. Interchangeable. So these volitional laws are the word, internal wisdom, and universal reason. And these are like also these words are interchangeable too. And like I said before, these expressions are the wisdom of God himself because these laws express or are expressions of God. So these expressions of wisdom are coming from God insofar that it is his wisdom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And these laws, these expressions, I got lost. These laws that are expressions of God, like universal reason, I hone in on that one because that's the one that makes the most sense.
Right.
Like, when you say it out loud, like, the word doesn't make sense.
Right.
So the expressions of God, like universal reason, are what gives humans the faculty for rationality.
Yeah.
So these expressions of God, these laws, like universal reason, is what makes us capable or gives us the capability to use rationality. And I don't need to No, that's the other question, so I don't need to explain that. This is straightforward. I feel like I'm repeating myself a lot, but it's just clarifying. So therefore, human's rationality is the word or the wisdom of God himself, right. Just because it is his expression.
Right, of him. Right.
But Malebranche makes the point that my own... You good? Oh, okay. Oh, you coughed?
Yeah.
So, like, Malebranche makes this point, if my own particular mind, me...
Yeah.
Were my reason, it would be the reason of all intelligent beings... And that's not the case because we're not universal. We're like particular instances.
And Kant just makes this point that it is.
Yeah.
But go on.
Where was I at? Oh, yeah. So it would be the reason of all intelligent beings, but my mind is not my reason. Human's mind is God's rationality, basically.
Yeah.
Dude, he's kind of actually simple, but like weirdly confusing.
Well, I don't think he's confusing. I think he's just contradictory and he sucks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
Like, his philosophy is just bad. It's just bad. It's just a lot of, like, submit to God.
Yeah, like, moral, yeah. So, okay. Humans are particular beings, but the rationality that humans have is universal. That is because God and his reason are universal. Since God's rationality is universal, the rationality is the rationality of all intelligent beings. And this is important because all intelligent beings have some society with God because of this rationality or reason.
Exactly. And importantly, that's the only way that we can get at God.
Yeah, is through reason.
And you need to talk about the immutable order, too, to understand why we should want to get with God.
This is where I'm having the society that follows after. So since we humans have this rationality, we have some sort of society of God, like I said. So this is because... Okay. I am... So rationality allows us to contemplate some of the truth that God knows because all intelligent beings are contemplating in this divine substance or thinking through God. So one of these truths that is the will of God, and God wills nothing but according to a certain order. And this order is just basically there's things that are more loved than other things. So humans are more loved than animals, like a dog or something like that.
Right.
And animals are more loved than a rock.
Yeah.
And then angels are more loved than humans.
Because of their perfections.
Yeah, because of their perfections. Yeah.
And perfection.
Yeah.
What constitutes perfection is the ability to reason.
Yeah. Yeah. So So they're more loved because of this perfection, and I kind of worded it like this. It was like they resemble God the most, but it's because they have, but you're right. Like you said, they have this reason that's more similar. Like animals and like rocks don't have that particular reason or have reason.
Right.
So, and since each of these orders are more loved than the other because they resemble God more than the other.
Yeah.
And that's because of some have reason more than the other, basically.
Yeah. Some are more universal and God is universal.
Universal, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm. Is that the whole answer?
No. So, yeah, this is the poor mark. So, through this contemplation, using the faculty of reason, we can recognize God's will, which is according to some order, like I said. Reason, more importantly, used to discover the relations of greatness or perfection. Oh, I already said this, basically.
Yeah.
Is that the whole answer? So, reason allows us to see the relations of perfection of these things. It is, yeah. Oh, I think I just covered the whole answer.
Good.
Oh, yeah. So just wrap it up. Malebranche thinks that reason gives the ability to contemplate and discover these relations of perfections that is the will of God or God's will. So living according to these perfections that we're discovering through reason is how we achieve a virtuous life, because moral duty for Malebranche is just a duty to God. So as long as you're living in accord to these perfections, you're going to be virtuous because God's going to make, like, that's the correct thing to do, and God's gonna make you happy.
Yeah, he will reward you, not because he's choosing to, as if there were another option, but because it is in his nature. Like, it is a part of being happy.
Yeah.
Or sorry, it's a part of acting in accordance with perfection that you get happiness.
Yeah, I think I need to reword my answer. I kind of repeated myself a lot. Well, no, I don't think I repeated myself. I think I was just clarifying points. Do you think that sounded fine? I don't know.
I thought it sounded all right, yeah.
I mean, it's just a take-home exam, so I don't have to be, like, too meticulous about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
My first one?
Yeah.
Okay. The question is, and DJ Geist also did this one.
So. Yeah, I'm the Malebranche guy, apparently.
Yeah. Pride is an important notion in Malebranche's moral theory and in Hume's moral theory. Explain the roles in both theories and explain how these follow from more basic notions for each. So my answer is, in the moral theory of Malebranche, pride, hereafter referred what I'll refer to now as grandeur, it plays an important role. Alike to Hume, Malebranche sees grandeur as stemming from a sort of natural inclination.
Yeah.
So it's not
necessarily bad.
Yeah, no. Yeah. No. Hume doesn't think pride's bad.
No, I was saying Malebranche doesn't think it's necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah, but I wanted to lay out first that it stems from a natural inclination. So
that's important. Yeah.
So that, because the more basic notion is that it comes from a natural inclination and that we have natural inclinations. And he goes about proving this. So as a natural inclination, quote, in the search for truth, he says, impressed on our will is the love of ourselves or of our own preservation. So importantly, this grandeur is a love of our own preservation. And that plays important role later. However, to understand Malebranche's concept of grandeur, we got to explain the core of Malebranche's ethical theory. So following the rationalist tradition of Descartes, Malebranche places a very large emphasis on the importance of universal reason. So DJ Geist just explained this.
Yeah.
And getting away from the senses in order to find pure universal truth.
Yeah.
Malebranche thinks that this can be achieved if we retire into our minds. It will become clear that there is this immutable order which ranks all existent beings.
Yeah.
Again, this was just explained with ranks God at the top.
Ranks because things
ranks in order of perfection.
Yeah.
With God at the top, God being the most perfect because he's the most reasonable. He is universal. But he's not just this sort of like intellect thing, this like reason. He's not just reason. Yeah. He's also got this will.
Yeah. He wants to say God is reason, but not just reason.
Yeah, exactly. God is reason, but he also has a will, and he wills after contemplating on these on this intellect.
Yeah.
One of these things that God wills were these sort of like natural inclinations of the mind. So, keeping in the dualist structure, right? So he's coming from Descartes, where there's these substances, mind and body. Malebranche goes about proving the necessity of the more basic principle, that which is a natural inclination, that we have natural inclinations, right? So he goes about proving it through proof of the necessity of motion in bodies. So it's on like page 265 of his Search After Truth. He states that if God had produced infinitely extended matter without impressing any motion on it, there would not have been bodies that constitute the beauty of the universe and lead all minds to admire the infinite wisdom of him who governs it. So here we can see he's saying, like, if there wasn't anything to move, there would be no like separate thing from God to admire God's perfection. And God created us in order for us to admire him.
Yeah.
So therefore God necessarily had to create motion in bodies. And he believes that this is comparable to the sort of mental realm.
Yeah.
Insofar as if every mind were without inclinations or never willed anything, there would not be the variety that arouses admiration for the profundity of God's wisdom, as he says.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't have love of God if there wasn't a sort of like separate mind to do that.
Yeah.
And he goes about grandeur in the way of like preservation of being, and this is where we kind of get that. So given that he takes to have proven that our mind has natural inclinations, he moves forward to this particular inclination of self-love or of our own preservation. I need to mark that out. And this inclination towards self-love splits into two different types, the love of pleasure and the natural inclination to grandeur.
Yeah.
This love of grandeur, which is concerned with
love of being and well-being.
Yeah, exactly. That's a different way that he phrases it.
I hate when philosophers do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And he kind of phrases it weird too. Like he's like the love of pleasure and of grandeur and I'm like, is he talking about is the two here?
Also, like when he talks about like being, sometimes I think he's just talking about well-being for some reason. Because it makes sense like that. Well, that just seems like being. That seems like you're talking about your well-being.
Right.
When he talks about self-subsistence, I'm like, wow.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. It's a weird wording. But anyways, this inclination splits into two. The love of grandeur is what we're specifically concerned with here.
Yeah, I explained both. That's funny.
Really?
Yeah.
This love of grandeur, which is concerned with power and self-subsistence, stems from the desire to exist necessarily, though we as humans are contingent.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if he wants to use it. I had that in there, but I X'd it out because I don't know if he wants to use that language.
You don't think so?
Because, well, no, I think he thinks we're contingent.
But they hate Aristotle, so like I don't know if they would want to use that language.
Right.
Like we're particulars.
I think I'm going to leave it.
I mean, it does the same thing.
Yeah.
Particulars and contingent, yeah.
Right. This desire for power, this desire to like go above, leads us to want to be independent from God, which is exactly the opposite of what we're supposed to be doing, right?
Yeah.
Under Malebranche's theory, our whole point is to love God.
Yeah, grandeur, it's weird because God gives you the self-love because he wants you to love him like he loves you.
Yeah, exactly.
But then this leads you to love yourself and find the end happiness within yourself. And he wants to say, you can't do that, bud.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he wants... Yeah, exactly. So it's this idea of like, once you get a taste for power, so you have this natural inclination to power because it helps you survive, and you survive... And surviving is necessary to love God, to find your happiness in God. So God necessarily has to give us this inclination to grandeur. But it can also lead us to get a little arrogant and say, actually, I can provide my own happiness. And that's where the problem comes in. So it's concerned with, let's see, this desire for power leads us to want to be independent from God and above him. Hence where the error in grandeur can come in.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to note that grandeur for Malebranche doesn't render creatures happier by themselves, since it often happens that one becomes miserable in proportion to the increase in one's grandeur.
Yeah. That was a fine point. I was
right.
Like, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So therefore we can kind of come to our conclusion here that the inclination to grandeur itself is no vice, as it is only faced towards that self-subsistence which is necessary for the happiness we get from aiming ourselves at God.
Yeah. Wait, say that again, that last sentence?
Let's see. Hold on. I think I have that phrased weird. So it's no vice, as it is only... existent. As it is... Let's see. This is better. As it is necessary... So that, okay, hold on, I gotta rephrase this. Thus, we can come to our conclusion that the inclination of grandeur itself is no vice, as it is necessary.
I gotta write a couple so sentences. So that online.
We can find happiness in God.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Yeah, I don't know. I'm gonna have to like change my. I'm gonna have to add a couple sentences. I left out some important parts.
Yeah.
Let me
finish this up. I have like two sentences left.
Yeah, you're good.
However, grandeur's natural longing to be universal can lead us away from God, and thus constitutes a disordered aim.
Mm-hmm.
So we mustn't assent to this error in the natural inclination.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I don't have to add a sentence because I talk about pleasure too, and I didn't even talk about pleasure. I can just wrap it up and say pleasure and grandeur both lead to this notion of like wanting you to be independent of God, but both of this is still dependent on God because God is the only thing that can grant you happiness.
Exactly. Yeah. So given that love of grandeur is concerned with the perfection of ourselves, I don't know if that's right.
Yeah.
And Malebranche's philosophy as a whole is... Yeah, I think I might just take this whole sentence out. Yeah, I'm just going to. Okay. Now, we've talked about Malebranche. So let's talk about Hume, right? In the moral theory of Hume.
You talk so much about Hume, dude.
Actually, we got to run ads. I just realized it's 9 o'clock.
Oh, shit.
We'll be back, guys.
Dude, no one listens.
What's up? This is Stu Woozy, and you're listening to KVRX Austin HD1 and HD2.
Over 200 million Americans are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. However, the fight against COVID is far from over. Fewer people are getting infected due to higher vaccination rates, but the majority of counties still face medium to high threat of COVID-19. You can love yourself and the ones around you and help stop the spread of COVID by getting vaccinated and boosted. Community immunity is the key. This message is brought to you by Sewa International, a Hindu faith-based humanitarian organization.
This program is brought to you in part by Pod ATX Fest. coming to the UT Austin campus August 16th through 19th.
The conference is open to all levels of podcasting experience, including professionals, journalists, hobbyists, and students.
Sessions feature industry leaders like Laura Buell of Dr. Death.
Yeah, so see, now it shouldn't be recording. So this should be recording on Spotify, but not recording on not recording on air.
Oh, nice.
Can you hear this on air? Can you hear this through the headphones? Like, can you hear me talking right now at all?
Nope.
That's amazing. Okay. So, hey guys, we're not going to run ads for y'all anymore.
I think we have 3 shows left. We're going to do our own podcast after this, boys.
Yeah, yeah. If you guys are interested, let us know.
So it seems humans are... Okay. The love of pleasure is the desire of well-being that is the most agreeable to the soul. This means pleasure in the general sense. Yeah, he does talk about pleasure. You do your best. He just brings pleasure. You do your best and you spell
it today. So, all right, guys. So let's move on to Hume. So Hume, in the moral theory, pride plays a large role, and in some instances, the greatest role. Get to those specific instances in a minute, but yeah, we just,
I think we did the opposite.
But those thinkers like Malebranche view rationality and reason as the way to get at the right and wrong action. Hume can properly be known as sentimentalist, right? So he also has a place for reason.
Yeah. No one really cares.
And I think Hume even talked about that. Oh, where he's like, sorry guys, I just realized y'all have been listening to music this whole time. Sorry about that.
Are we back on air?
Yeah. No, we're not back on air. I'm playing music on air right now, but I'm playing. We're just talking to the Spotify groupies.
Oh, nice.
But okay.
Oh, we got groupies.
Yeah. So for Hume, the sentiments are a type of impression that invoke pleasure or pain.
Yeah.
And specifically, sentiments are the impression that we use for moral determination.
Mm-hmm.
So this comes in from the idea, and this comes from the idea impression distinction that Hume draws, with ideas being strictly mental qualities that are less lively, and impressions being those vivacious and more
You good?
Yeah, I gotta fix my wording. This comes from the idea. Yeah. An impression being those more vivaciously experienced things.
Mm-hmm.
These impressions break down into both original and secondary, with original being those sentiments derived from immediate sensory experience. Pride, however, falls under the secondary impression category.
Mm-hmm.
So we won't go any further on original.
Okay.
It's these secondary impressions that are further classified into calm and violent.
Yeah.
Right. And the violent secondary impressions, as Hume describes it, is what was commonly thought of as passions,
mm-hmm,
for previous philosophers. It's under this classification of violent secondary impressions or passions that we find pride in Hume's moral philosophy. So being the subject of his first 2 books of the Treatise of Human Nature, though not exactly in the same manner.
Yeah.
Pride plays a great role in our moral judgment when it comes to those natural virtues which are agreeable to ourself. And that's really important wording there, and I'm going to explain it. But what's up?
That's hot.
You good?
Yeah.
It's important here to explain 2 key distinctions that make pride fit into this very specific category of morally positive evaluation for Hume. The first distinction to make is that of natural and artificial virtues. Artificial virtues are those that arise from their utility, and without convention would not have otherwise been a notion or sentiment in the human mind. So the prime example for Hume here is justice, right?
Talking about the effect stuff? Like, we only know these things through effect?
Artificial virtues.
Oh, you're talking about art. Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So artificial virtues are those that arise from their utility, and without convention would not have otherwise been a notion or sentiment in the human mind.
Yeah.
The prime example for Hume here, would not have otherwise come about. So the prime example for Hume here is justice, right? The natural virtues, however, have no dependence on the artifice and contrivance of men, as he puts it in the treatise. So, meaning they're sort of written in as a part of human nature, so far as we can observe.
Yeah, but what we have observed about human nature. He doesn't particularly talk about essences.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
But these natural virtues are determined by pleasure, pride, or pain and humility. When it comes to our specific interest, love and hatred also play a role, but that's not like, for our purposes.
Yeah, that's like vices, right?
Yeah. No, well, love and hatred are in relation to another.
Oh, yeah.
Agreeable
to
others.
Others, yeah.
That brings us to our second distinction. Hume delineates all of these moral valuations into four categories. That which is useful to others, useful to oneself, agreeable to others, and agreeable to oneself. So those actions which involve pride are those naturally agreeable virtues to oneself. They are agreeable in so much as they, and this is a quote, have a tendency to produce pleasure, in the possessor.
Yeah.
So finally, to sort of achieve the clearest conception of the role and importance of pride for Hume, we have to understand why it is an indirect passion. For Hume, indirect passions involve a, quote, double relation of impressions and ideas, meaning that there is not just an impression of an immediately pleasing action indicative of an internal character trait, but also an understanding that the action has a sufficiently close relationship to yourself. So, for example, I may go into my closet and say, like, it doesn't matter. I may see a person with a jacket on that's really, really nice and say, wow, that's a really nice jacket. That's a morally positive or pleasing sentiment, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not closely related to myself.
Nope.
So to have pride, I can't just be pleased by a thing like I am the coat, where I go, wow, that's a really nice coat. I also have to go, oh, and that's also my coat.
Yeah.
It's a really nice coat, and I have it, so I can have pride in having that coat.
Ooh, I gotta mention that. My example, I left that out of my example.
Right. But also an understanding that the action has a sufficiently close relation to yourself. So closing with an example of pride, I may take pride in my specific knowledge about Nordic noir as a genre. Here I take knowledge of Nordic noir to be immediately pleasant and agreeable, and I also attach that commendable thing to myself, taking pride in it as a natural virtue. And that kind of explains the concept. And we're going to get back on air. So let me give me 2 seconds, guys. I'm going to fade this.
I left out I explained.
We're back on air. Hey, guys.
I explained the whatchamacallit.
Right.
Like the pleasurable. Like it's to an object.
Yeah.
But I forgot to directly explain pride, how it's not just an object. It's like an object related to you.
Right.
I forgot I left that out. Yeah, you went in way more detail. We did the opposite. I set up Mala Ranch way before I got to the self-love. Like, there's all this, and this is how we get self-love.
yeah. That's good, though. That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, guys, if you guys are listening and you have any burning philosophy questions, you can always call us at
512-495-5879.
That's 512-495-5879.
512-495.
You want to try again?
512-489.
Nope. 512-495-5879.
Yeah. 512-495-8579.
Nope. That was still wrong. 512-495-5879.
I only got right the first time. Give up.
Yeah. You nailed it that first time, though.
Yeah.
Should have just hit it and quit it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of hard to do that sometimes, you know?
Yeah, I feel you. Anyways,
that
so.
That shit crazy.
So.
Yeah. Mahler Branch is crazy.
Yeah. So what we were doing. We're
definitely putting Mahler Branch down after this.
Yeah. So what we were doing was, before the break, we were talking about.
Just explain the pride part on air.
Yeah. What?
Does it like, you can probably, no.
No, we already explained it. So.
No, okay.
We're going to move on to the next question. What's your next question?
I don't know. We both did the same last question.
Hearst House? Okay. So do you want me to do my next one and then we'll do Hearst House together, or what are you thinking? Do you want to do Hearst House now?
Yeah, because we did
Well, we did two answers out of the same, huh? 7 and 4.
Yep.
What was your second?
I have 5.
What was 5? Can you hear me?
Hold on. Magnanimity.
Can you hear me?
Can you not hear you on air?
Hold on. Oh, shit. Say, can you put in the thing? Dude, we're having technical problems, I think. Wait, am I on?
Yeah.
Oh.
Here, try it again.
Oh, you turn.
This guy did.
I quit.
You good over there, dude?
Yeah.
All right.
I'm shook.
Okay. What do we want to do?
Well, you didn't mention all the good stuff about Mala Branch, dude.
Okay, but we're not. What do you mean all the good stuff?
Dude, I'm a Mala Branch. I'm a Mala Branch scholar. All
right.
Dude.
Well, if you have more to say, go on and say it.
Oh, let's see. Do I have anything that's important?
About his pride.
Grandeur is straightforward. So it was pleasure. You nailed grandeur fine.
Okay.
The setup for is not. You know, I don't need to go through the setup for the.
Okay, so let's.
Because the setup's just saying, like, these things are like. Like, you have these things. Like, God puts. Imbues his oppression on you. Right. But, like, it leads to this, and then. He sets up these things. You know,
right.
Yeah, it's like what we already talked about.
Yeah.
I just did it in a more, like, laid out way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's cover my next question.
Yeah, you might as well, because we have 7 or the same, yeah.
Yeah. Let's cover my next question. We have 12 minutes, and then we'll spend the last 30 minutes on the Hearst House question. Does that sound good?
Yeah. Because okay. I might need to flesh out my objection.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So... Let's talk about my next question. So the next question is, hey, by the way, guys, we're a philosophy talk show. If you're not a upper level philosophy person, I apologize for tonight.
Yeah,
we're just like going crazy.
Yeah,
but it's fine.
I'm not sorry. I'm a gatekeeper.
But anyway, so for both Aristotle, here's the question: for both Aristotle and Hume, greatness of mind counts as a virtue. Explain what it is. In your own words, that greatness of mind is, then explain why it qualifies as a virtue for Aristotle and why it qualifies as a virtue for Hume.
Matt had a great point. These questions are not clear, dude. In your own words? In my own words doesn't have to be correct.
I'll tell you, it doesn't. It really doesn't. But, okay, I want to see what you think of this, because I'm not so sure how I feel about it.
I think there's a lot of similarities between Hume and Aristotle.
I do, too.
And I think Aristotle is superior.
I would disagree. But I think there's some very stark differences.
Oh, yeah, well, definitely.
Yeah. So, here's my own definition.
I don't have 5 on mine, so.
No, yeah, I'm just reading it to you.
Okay.
Here's my own definition of greatness of mind. To be broad enough to encompass both theories as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
Greatness of mind is the virtuous character trait, be it natural or habituated, of an individual to want or even require a justified social praise and honor of the great person that they are.
That sounds fine to me. Like, let me think, hold on. Aristotle. Yeah, because, I mean, well, greatness of soul for Aristotle, but mind also. Oh, that's my button up there. Yeah, that sounds fine to me. Like, I don't...
I think it sounds good, right? I mean, it's not... Exact, but it is my own words, right? So it doesn't have to encompass Hume and Aristotle's theory. Maybe I should take that part out to be broad enough to encompass both theories.
Well, no, wait. Read the sentence to me again. Hold on.
Greatness of mind is the virtuous character trait, be it natural, that's Hume,
yep,
or habituated, that's Aristotle, of an individual to want or even require a justified social praise and honor of the great person that they are.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. You could probably take out the first part because you mentioned habituation and
right
natural. You got to refresh me. What is he thinks it's natural? I forgot.
Yeah, he thinks pride is a natural virtue because he discusses it in the second half of the treatise, or the second book. Sorry, the second chapter of the third book of the treatise.
You know, I read 20 pages of that stuff.
Here, I'll pull it up because I'm gonna need to look at it a little bit. So yeah, section 2 of book 3 of the treatise, he talks about, it's the chapter title is Of the Greatness of Mind, and he's talking about essentially it because it falls into agreeableness, right? So we should keep in mind here, guys. So he talks about this as pride in his words, but he's not talking about the pride that he just talked about in the last chapter.
It's a different pride
of natural virtues and vices, and he does something similar with benevolence, in the sense that,
yeah, he has like two notions.
In the sense that, like, he uses the word benevolence to represent two different things.
Yeah, there's a specific virtue that is benevolence, and then there's a general idea of benevolence.
Benevolence as written into human nature.
Yeah.
And so in the same sense, that which you naturally have pride for is just an indirect passion. Mm-hmm. That's just a part of human nature that helps us address that which is agreeable to oneself.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is the specific virtue of agreeableness to oneself that is pride,
yeah,
and that's having pride in oneself,
that's this particular case, or like the specified case of pride.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
because
it's in relation to yourself, right? Where it's not where it's not just talking about human nature.
Yeah exactly.
I'm following.
So we talk about Hume, but let's talk about Aristotle first to understand why
Aristi, I like.
Greatness of mind fits as a virtue for Aristotle. We first have to understand what qualifies something as a virtue for Aristotle in general, right?
Uh-huh.
Aristotle's project of ethics is concerned at the core with, okay, and this is where I might need to change my wording.
Okay.
With living in accordance with reason in order to achieve the end goal, the telos, of humanity, which is flourishing. That sounds right to me.
Yeah, you know, it sounds right. I think it's a general, it's a general explanation of Aristotle. But I think reading them when he was telling you that, they do Aristotle like specially, like that's their specialty.
Right.
So they're gonna get in like the nitty, like your general case is not gonna be cover the nitty gritty of what Aristotle's what he thinks Aristotle's getting at.
Aristotle's project of ethics is concerned at the core with living in accordance with reason and virtue.
Mm-hmm.
Living in accordance with reason in order to achieve the end goal of humanity, which is flourishing, eudaimonia.
Yeah, so I wrote, Aristotle thinks human good can be defined by identifying the function of a human. The human good is rational activity, performed well, and is in accordance with virtues. So you have to perform these virtues excellently. And I guess, right, like, eventually you'll...
Wait, can you say that? Can you say that again?
Yeah, I wrote, human good is rational activity performed well and is in accordance with virtues. That's what I wrote.
Rational activity performed well.
Mm-hmm. And the performed well is just the habituating part.
Performed well, say it again, the rest of it.
Oh, and is in accordance with virtues. Well, I guess in accordance with virtues is the habituating part.
Okay. That being said, if there is a character trait that can help us achieve that end, and...
That's weird, though. Now that I worded that way, how do you perform rational activity well? Oh, I guess this is when you just habituate your virtues like it's like second nature or something like that. Yeah, never mind. I understand it.
That being said, there are... character traits.
We're writing a paper live on air, boys.
For real. That help us achieve that end.
This was like writing a philosophy paper. Oh, I don't understand. You say it aloud. Oh, no, I understand.
Yeah. And it is performed to the... And... so long. What's up?
So, DJ Geis is the spirit that keeps it moving, dog.
No, for real. Okay. And so long as it is performed to the proper intermediate, meaning you do not perform... it to an excess or deficiency.
Is Aristotle a particularist?
Can we focus? I'm trying to like get this paper down.
True.
Then this moderate trait is considered virtuous in so much as it reasonably gets us at the human telos of eudaimonia. With greatness of mind in particular, there are a few criteria that must be met. One, as stated roughly in my own definition, is that the greatness of mind person must think himself worthy of great things and is really worthy of them. This is put in contrast with a person who thinks himself worthy of great things and indeed is not, the vicious excess of being vain. Importantly, the distinction is not with the grandiosity of the claims, but the support with which they can be backed.
Yeah.
In opposition, the person worthy of great things who believes himself not to be, the vicious deficiency of being what he calls pusillanimous. I don't even know what that means.
Dude, this is a good word, pusillanimous.
Yeah, it's a good word, right?
I'm going to start saying that. People think it's like a
slur or something. I don't know. That sounds bad. But anyway.
Weirdly sexual.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's like, bro, what do you want to do to me?
But, and a stark contrast from a few of the later to come Christian ethics, right? Mm-hmm. He's also set in contrast with a person who thinks. So he's set in contrast with a third person, the magnanimous person, but the person with greatness of mind, who thinks of himself as worthy in the proper manner, but has not done great things. Mm-hmm. This man is referred to as temperate, but not magnanimous or not having greatness of mind, because it's part of having greatness of mind that you do great things. Mm-hmm. You can't just do little things like, you know, give out a shirt.
Aristotle would definitely been a conservative or a self-help guy on YouTube.
Yeah.
Dude, wake up and do the hardest thing possible.
Exactly. Be a great one today. Earn your honor.
Earn your honor, dude. Fight
dear them. Athenians. And make sure you hit sub and subscribe. Okay, Aristotle, chill out, dude. Okay. So
that's the funny thing, so he's kind of self-helpy.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. So to achieve the virtue of greatness of mind, however, one must arguably be held to a higher standard, as it's not simply a virtue that one can have, but a virtue that implies all of the other virtues in a person. Because you can't be great unless you have all the other virtues, right?
Yeah.
Saying that,
sure. The crown of virtues.
Yeah, exactly. Surely it would not fit a magnanimous person to run away from danger when a coward would, right? Given that the magnanimous person is the greatest person, magnanimity is a sort of adornment of the virtues, a crown of the virtues.
Adorno?
And it does not arise without them. Yeah. Aristotle also makes it requisite that the magnanimous person has the right concern with honor and dishonors, characterized by a moderate, justified regard and concern for the honor of their great achievements. The person with magnanimity is a virtuous person in so much as they can have a justified characteristic.
So do you achieve magnanimity? This is what I never understood. Do you achieve magnanimity after you achieve all these other virtues? And half of them he can't even freaking name. Like, what are we doing here, Aristotle?
Yeah. Yeah.
He only names like 7. The rest, he's just like, well, I don't know what they're called, but like, we can like say their excess and deficiency.
Pretty much.
Oh, dude. This guy's. Yeah.
He just said he was goated.
Oh, this metaphysics is kind of cool.
Like teleology stuff?
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Whether you disagree with it or not, it's a pretty big deal. Yeah,
I think you're a pretty big deal, DJ Geist.
Thank you, dude. I wish people at Juiceland thought that.
Ah, that's crazy.
No, I'm just playing.
Hey, it's at 9:30. Let's run ads.
Yeah, wait. Yeah, that is
on Spotify.
Oh, yeah, it's true. Okay.
All right, guys. Hey, we're going to run ads. We'll be right back. Love you.
Let me think.
Hello, this is Sinan from Dengue Fever. And you're listening to KVRX 91.7 in Austin.
I don't know why. Oh.
Support for this program comes from Kebabzu and Phoenician Restro Cafe.
What?
This is just Spotify.
Yeah, so I guess we can go on a little rants on here.
Yeah.
We should have been doing this. This is actually a smart idea. So it's like...
It's kind of hard for me to like keep up with, but yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
So it's like he wants to like... magnanimity is the crown of all... virtues, because you achieve this once you have all these other virtues habituated. And I guess Aristotle would say, yeah, I only named 7, but what I mean by all virtues being habituated is that you just know what the right thing to do in a particular instance, the ones he can't name.
Yeah.
So it's, once you figure that out, you're kind of mad. You have the, like, you're great. Like, you have this greatness.
Yeah.
But the thing is like, this was my thing with, like, Hurt House. Like, I think she and a lot of Aristotelians don't take serious the blindness of how to.
Hold on 1 second.
That's weird.
Let me turn the mics off real quick. Okay. I just had to make sure stuff was playing on air, guys. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah, like, I think Hurst House, and a lot of, Hurt House would be a cooler name, but Hurst House would, and a lot of Aristotelians, I think they really, like, don't take in serious consideration the blindness of, like, of how to apply the system and, like, what is actually virtuous. Like, it's pretty, not blindless, it's pretty blurry on what to do.
Oh, 100%.
Because it's like, listen.
I think she takes it into account. I think she just takes it as a non-problem.
Yeah. I mean, she doesn't problematize it. Because it's like this. It's like, every situation has a different particular character trait you should do. But also, here's another issue I wrote about. Say you face the same situation in three different cases, like three different times.
Right.
But in each case, it might be that you have to do something different in each case.
Right.
And it's like, well, like, then what is, like, really, like, virtuous? Like,
yeah.
Like, am I being virtuous, or am I just, like, kind of navigating through life?
That's my problem is, like, and this is kind of a tangent. This doesn't really deal with our project here. Yeah. But, like, the problem is, like, okay, let's say in one sense, doing the courageous thing is, like, staying and fighting, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the very next instance, doing the courageous thing is running away. The fuck away.
Yeah.
Because we can cuss on
We can fucking cuss, dude. This show is sponsored by Collins. No, okay. No, this show is sponsored by Collins Tongue.
That's crazy. No, but, like, yeah, the point being is, like, maybe sometimes it's, like, the courageous thing. So let's say in one instance, the courageous thing to do is to run away. One instance, the courageous thing to do is to stay and fight. Okay, so if I put those as a universal principle.
Yeah.
Contradictory. Mm. Can't have that, right? Mm-mm. So what have you told me by saying the virtuous thing to do is to be courageous? Yeah. And to be courageous is to do what the courageous person would do.
You didn't tell me how to be virtuous. You just told me, like, when to, like, run away and when to fight.
But not even really. You said to be courageous is to do what the courageous person would do. Okay, sometimes that's run away, sometimes that's stay and fight. How am I supposed to know, and how have you told me anything with that? You haven't told me anything with that. Then what he says is, well, you need prudence. You need practical wisdom to get you at that end. And how do you get that? Through experience. Okay, so really I just kind of need to figure it out. And it's basically him saying, again, hey, you kind of get it. If you get it, you get it. If you don't, you don't.
It's really not a virtuous life. It's just really how to navigate life. Like I think, I don't know if that makes sense, but, like, it's, I don't know if he tells you, like, it's like, I don't know, like, a virtuous, like, when I think of virtuous, right, it's like, that's just morally right to do. It seems when you really break down Aristotle's theory, it's like, he's not saying, you should do what the courageous person do. He's not saying that's the morally, like, right thing. He's just saying, like, there's some situations where we're going to call this, what you should do is be courageous, but, like, it's going to vary, and it's just like you're gonna have to navigate each situation differently. Like
Yeah, it's not my favorite. But let's talk about Hume. So let's talk about Hume's magnanimity.
Yeah, his is probably more interesting.
So although Hume also has the virtue of magnanimity present in his ethics, he takes a radically different conception of justifying it as a virtue than Aristotle, right? Because Aristotle's is very outward facing. Like the magnanimous man. For Aristotle, like, shows his magnanimity. He says at one point he's very open in his hatred.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, that is just not the case for
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Right?
What's virtuous about hating someone? Dude?
Yeah, and he wants honors. He seeks out honors. He doesn't just want honors, right? So instead of labeling virtue by that of practical reason Instead of labeling virtue by that of practical reason and traits, ends and traits aimed at flourishing in accordance with our telos. I think I took over. I may have to rewrite this Hume part.
Yeah, I had to like add things to my Hume part.
Let's see. And according to other theologians, Hume develops a conception of morals that derives virtue from sentiments based on observation, not just reason, right?
Mm-hmm.
So important to understanding what qualifies as a virtue for Hume is understanding his... Yeah, see, I think I need to rewrite all of this.
I love Spotify, man. Yeah, that's... Yeah, I'm going to have to like add some things to my freaking... My Hume section. Aristotle. Yeah, great. I think there's like too many similarities between like Aristotle and the sentiments. I just don't get this the sentiment thing. Not saying I don't like I don't actually get it, but like in more of the like slang way, like it just like I just disagree with it.
Right.
Like yeah.
Why do you disagree with it?
It seems my sentiments can lead to me to find, like, what about if my sentiment is just, like, so my sentiment, so, like, a virtuous thing is something that's, like, pleasurable. What about someone, like, finds, like, killing people pleasurable?
Right.
And my sentiment...
I think you would just have to say that that's okay.
That's crazy.
As long as it fits the culture in which you live. As long as it's agreeable to the society.
I don't know if he actually wants to say that, dude. None of these philosophers are... really hardcore, like, cultural, like, actual relevance.
I think he is. I think you would say as long as the contract that you've entered to in the society that you are finds it agreeable. Well, thank you. You disagree?
Yeah, I do kind of believe in some universal principles.
I don't really know where I stand on universal principles. I want to intuitively.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We're about to be back on air.
Okay.
And we are... back on air. Hey, guys. Back on KBRX 91.7.
I have some vague notion of universal principles. That was like the whole structuralist project, like when they did anthropology, like philosophical, like actual anthropology, but apply philosophy to it. They were like, here's all these cultures. There's a lot of similarities. But they have different like rules and things, but there seems to be like these overall overarching things, like
right.
Some like moral virtues or like universal principles like that, or like maybe like mythology and stuff, and mythologies where like a lot of like you catch like virtue, like
right.
I don't know if you right. Moral stories, not moral stories, or like
yeah, stories where morals can be pulled out.
Yeah.
But okay, so for Hume, yeah, I really screwed this question up.
Yeah, when you read your Hume one, I was like, I messed up bad.
Yeah, okay, so. The definition of sentiment is most concisely expressed on the 13th page of his inquiry, where he states that a sentiment is an immediate feeling and a finer internal sense.
It's on the 13th page of his inquiry. I get it, bro. You quoted the book.
Okay.
I paraphrased like a
G. Entirely. Well, she did say in the exam to put pages.
Did she really?
Yeah.
I thought it was optional.
I don't think it is, dude. Let me go look. Dude, you might be screwed.
Oh, I have no time, dude.
This thing's due in 2 hours.
Oh, no.
Let's see. The exam is due. This is an exam, not a paper.
Yeah, it's not a paper, bro.
Just try to answer the stated questions as clearly. Please support your answers with page number references to the assigned text.
Bro, don't confuse me like that, Dunlop. It's not a paper.
I don't know what to tell you, dude. It definitely says with
dude,
page number.
Dude, am I screwed?
You got to find those pages, dude.
Oh, I don't have them on me.
I could help you. I mean,
okay.
I could help you try and find them.
I just might submit it, dude. How much do you think?
I don't know. Probably a couple points, I guess. Is there a rubric?
Oh, that's a good point. I'm having a mental breakdown, boys. She's a very weird grader. She took off like 0.5 points on our project we thought we did great on. So
yeah, no rubric. That's up to you, dude. Do you know where your paraphrases are at in your?
No, not off the hand. But that first question is usually mostly from the first chapter of
Malebranche.
Yeah, treaties.
You can find them.
This show's over.
Fuck. We're back on air. Damn. Well, that's all right. There's nothing you can do about it now, honestly.
Yeah, what's the point of it not being in paper and then support your... Dude, pick one. Either or. You did logic.
Yeah.
This disjunction. Well, God created the laws that allowed me to do that, so it's God's fault.
Yep, that's it. And we're going to wrap the show up on that one. No, I'm kidding. But okay, yeah, so let's go on. Do you want to just move on to the virtue theory and abortion?
Yeah.
Okay. In Virtue Theory and Abortion, Rosalind Hursthaus considers the criticism that virtue theory centrally relies on the concept of the worthwhile. Explain in your own words how the notion of the worthwhile corresponds to the terms of Aristotle's ethical theory. Next, explain the criticism to which Hursthaus is responding. Finally, give Hursthaus's reply to the criticism. You get over there?
Yeah, I'm good, G.
Okay. So, I have written down. What's up?
Yeah, what you have written down?
The relation of the worthwhile and Aristotle's terminology. So, to me, it seems as though the concept of the worthwhile that Hursthaus is talking about relates to Aristotle's terminology of understanding and first principles in Book 6. I
just related it to human flourishing.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do.
But I did kind of mention stuff about it being intuitively grasped, though.
Hold on one second. It seems to Aristotle's terminology of eudaimonia, yeah. Eudaimonia, whatever it is.
Eudaimon.
As eudaimon. Grasped.
Eudaimon.
As grasped intuitively.
That's what happens when you don't read directions. Yeah, I've been doing philosophy for like 5 semesters and I still don't read directions sometimes.
To the understanding. From
she said, please try, okay? I tried.
She didn't say, please try. Please support your answers with page number references to the assigned text.
This ain't a take-home exam. I'm writing a paper for you.
Just say, you didn't say, pretty please with a cherry on top. I don't know what you wanted from me.
She's gonna be on my bad side if she grades me bad.
I think you'll be fine.
All right, I'm just gonna submit it.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, you don't really have much of a choice.
Like, yeah. Yeah, I just related it like to human flourishing, though. Like it's like worthwhile. Like, you can't have this intuitive idea of like, or like, for you to have some idea of like human good or what matters in life or human flourishing, it has to be like this worthwhile approach. It has to be like intuitively grasped. Like you have to like explore.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of that made sense.
No, it did. It did. So
I didn't read it. I was just going off the top.
Right. No, it was good. It was good stuff. But okay. So I say, here's my new sentence. Hursthaus is...
Bro wrote a sentence live on air, boys.
Hursthaus is talking about... the worthwhile that Hursthaus is talking about relates to Aristotle's terminology of eudaimonia as grasped intuitively through the understanding from Book 6.
Here's my page quote. Your mom.
Got him!
Got him, boys! Got him!
I'm reminded of this...
This show fell apart at the end.
This concept about the worthwhile in Aristotle's theory, when discussing his ethical system, Aristotle seems to take for granted, I don't want to say for granted.
Yeah, because he probably doesn't take it for granted. He probably just doesn't think it matters. Dude, that's the best thing about philosophers. We don't take nothing for granted. We just think things don't matter.
Yeah.
Honestly.
That eudaimonia. I'm just writing my paper at this point. Takes it.
I'm not even talking, dude. I'm having a mental break.
Takes it intuitively that eudaimonia is worthwhile
For the idea of what matters in human life to be pursued has to be worthwhile to be pursued. This seems like it's
living that virtuous and content life, which is accompanied
intuitively grasped because what matters in life is worthwhile.
Living that content life, which is accompanied with things like virtues, friendship, and liberation.
I'm content with this paper, without page references.
Are intuitively good. It is these intuitively good. It is these intuitively good things that we grasp through the understanding.
Y'all just listen to DJ DeMorgan's voice. Colin's out, dude. Boy tapped out. Look at that guac guac 500. Quit.
The guasa. Guasas. So I don't need that sentence. They are not good for something else.
Just
but perhaps
play music, bro. You
should read it. Worthwhile.
Don't write this, just read it.
Worthwhile in themselves because they are good intrinsically and intuitively.
That's so, so funny. Bro.
We were like, hey, we're going to KVRX and edit our paper.
Bro. Oh, shoot. Bro.
That's qual.
This is some high quality stuff.
You having a little psych break over there, buddy?
Yeah.
Okay. The criticism Hearst House is responding to. Although Hearst House addresses 9 separate objections to virtue theory in her paper, she considers the final 2, really one major objection split into 2 parts, to be the most substantial. This objection involves first the claim that virtue theory ethics have no argument for why particular actions exemplify virtues.
Yep.
They simply have virtue and vice concepts enshrined in their rules, right? So all action guiding rules rely on the virtues and vice concepts. But these virtues are merely asserted and not justified, making virtue theory all assertion and no argument. Right? So
let me see, hold on. Yeah, dude, some of her like some of her replies to objections was like, dude, virtue theory, she was like, dude, this was her opinion, this was her. What are you talking about, dude? Virtue theory like takes into account like putting these rules and actions very hard. Like it's literally a part of the process. Every instance is different.
Yeah.
That was literally her. But it wasn't her.
Yeah.
These objections, her replies to these objections are like
no, they're really bad. I kind of hated it. The second objection that Hearst House attempts to lay out charitably is that virtue theories presuppose an agreed-upon standard of what constitutes a good or a worthwhile life, right? This is going back to the first question.
Yeah.
There is, once again, no argument as to why living in accordance with these virtues is good or worthwhile.
Yeah. She just questions, like, what do you think this adequacy entails?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're presenting a virtue theory, you have to sort of rely on the audience's agreeing with your application of all these concepts, like the worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Even under the system itself, some other virtue theorist might take different premises about these systems, about these matters, and come up with very different conclusions, right? Like
that's
Hume.
The critique, yeah.
Like Hume does with Aristotle stuff. He's a virtue theorist, but he comes up with different conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
How do you defend that? And you would have no way to delineate which is adhering to the theory and which is not. Think on our last question about how Hume and Aristotle, both virtue theorists, came to different conclusions about what constitutes the magnanimous person, right?
Dude, her response is, dude, if like normative ethics didn't appeal to worthwhileness about
then
the
what else? Life, what else?
Dude, what grounds normal ethics theory? Normal ethical theory. Anything else? Yeah. Duty? I don't
anything
know.
Anything else? Like, yeah. It's these two reasons that Hearst House views now you got me saying it, dude.
Hearst House.
It's these two it's reasons that Hearst House views as her I'm gonna change that to claims. That Hearst House views as her biggest objections. I'll lose it on this show right now.
I think dude, if this drops me down to like a 96 or 95, I will never mind.
Okay. Hursthaus puts a response to both questions in the frame of mistaken and implausible conditions of adequacy, right, for a normative moral theory, right? So to respond to the first problem about having no argument or rational grounding for virtues, Hursthaus states...
is not the strongest. Why did I put is the strongest? I just lied on my own paper.
What's that?
I put is... I'm going to say her... I don't think her replies are... Or is the or not the strongest.
Oh, right, right, right.
And I put is the strongest.
Hursthaus states that idea... okay, that's what I was
Dude, this is too good, dude. Her reply to me just suggests that other ethical views that are inadequate... Other ethical views... Whoa, what sentence did I write here, dude?
I don't know, man.
I'm gonna read what I wrote on air, dude.
Hold on, hold on. Let me finish this point, and then
finish this point, dude.
Gives the idea that moral knowledge doesn't need to be clearly luminous to individuals. It's not a correct condition of adequacy for a moral theory to force it to provide easy answers to moral questions, because answering moral questions is difficult and dependent upon experience. With her relying here on the Aristotelian conception of how moral knowledge is gained, experience, right? The crux of her response being that it's not realistic for a normative moral theory to provide an argument or convince others of the validity of the conclusions that it has drawn. And that's her response to the first objection. What you got?
I said, like, the first objection does not take seriously the vagueness of how virtue theory is to be applied. Like, she was like, because all she says, it takes into account, like, it's hard to apply this, like, the ought.
Yeah.
Because you have to habituate these things, and it's hard to, like, figure out
right
ought to do. But once you habituate them, I guess her point is you just know what to do.
Yeah.
I said the virtue theorist might say each situation will call for different character traits. It recognizes that it's difficult to apply the ought, but never gives a clear instance of what to do, since each situation will call for different character traits to be used and even used in the same situation. Whoa. It recognizes that it's difficult to apply the ought, but never gives a clear instance of what to do, since each situation will call for different character traits to be used, and even in the same situation could call for a different trait to apply. So it's just like my critique of the first objection is, like, you really don't have like a ought of what to do. There's no virtuous life. You're just telling me do something, figure it out.
Yeah. So
her second objection, trash.
Yeah. In response to the second question, Hursthaus argues what she views as the opposition of her view into absurdity.
Oh, we're doing dialectics. You're saying the objections, and I'm responding to them.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Hursthaus proposes to the reader that it's absurd to not consult the worthwhile when answering moral questions, because this opens her up to absurdities. Like I might sensibly seek guidance about what I ought to do from someone who had declared in advance that she knew nothing about moral matters.
No, that feels like strawmanny.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Why did you jump to that conclusion? Yeah. That scenario.
Right, agreed. Surely we don't want to allow these people to answer our moral questions in a way that doesn't rub against our theories grain, as it were. Given this absurdity of the opposing option, her conclusion is that the relevant condition of adequacy should be that the practical conclusions of a good normative theory must be in part determined by premises about what is worthwhile. Premises, importantly, being presumptions.
Yeah, right? Presumptions of, like,
or intuitions.
What matters in life, yeah.
Yeah. Hursthaus is now claiming that it is not just an insufficient quality for a moral theory to consult a premised worthwhile when it comes to moral decision-making, but that doing so is itself a condition of adequacy. You have to have it. You have to consult a worthwhile.
Yeah, she's just saying, she just says, it's not inadequate, it is adequate, because that's what grounds it, because nothing else can ground normative ethical theories.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's an important note of logic that premises are the beginning assumptions. And thus, Hursthaus is once again saying something to the extent that I needn't justify that living in accordance with these virtues makes life worthwhile. I simply use them as a referent.
I thought about that Sartre play in that one weird line. Sorry.
What? But is this, you think that sounds good?
Oh, that sounds good.
I needn't justify that living in accordance with these virtues makes life worthwhile.
Yeah, she did.
I simply use them as a referent.
Yeah. Yeah, she used a referent because she just thinks that's what grounds normative ethics.
Exactly. Okay, well, we got 4 minutes left. I don't know.
All right, dialectics right here.
Go on.
I gotta find my section. Second objection. The second objection is really just saying what other principle are we to use than this idea of the worthwhile to explain what matters in human life. It seems there could be other notions to apply, like some concept of duty from Connor Malebranche. And that's all I say. It's like it doesn't seem necessary that like worthwhileness is the only thing that grounds normative ethical theories. Like you could come up with other concepts. But then she'll do that circular and, well, that's just, you know, that's just worthwhile. The goodwill's just worthwhile.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm screwed. Hey, do you know what page is? I can quote. All this was all from the same page. Do you know the pages?
Pages of what? Hey, guys, we're going to cut Spotify off right here so that I can download the recording a little early. Spotify, we love you. Mwah.
Is it